I next met with Dr. Keith Stewart to discuss multiple myeloma in what's been a pretty big year in terms of clinical research in that disease. And to begin, he commented on two landmark data sets presented in June in Chicago.
The ASCO meeting this year was another landmark for myeloma in that there were two very large phase 3 trials published, which will have clinical impact over the next year or two. We can get into each of them, but one of them involved the first monoclonal antibody, elotuzumab, to be studied in myeloma and was a positive trial. And the second one continued to explore the use of the new proteasome inhibitor, carfilzomib, and its impact in the setting of relapse. And these were both relapse studies, but they set the stage for some other data that was presented in the newly diagnosed setting.
So why don't we go through that, beginning with the elotuzumab study. Can you talk, first of all, a little bit about what elotuzumab is, what the thinking is about how it works, and then what was reported in this trial?
Yeah, so elotuzumab is a monoclonal antibody which is targeting a cell surface receptor somewhat unique to myeloma cells called SLAMF7. And SLAM is for lymphocyte adhesion molecule. So this is a lymphocyte-restricted marker, making the antibody quite specific for plasma cells. It's also expressed on natural killer cells in the human body. And the mechanism of action seems to be both a dual direct impact on the myeloma cells, but some of the thinking is that may not be quite as critical now as the impact it has on activating natural killer cells to recognize plasma cells coated with the antibody for destruction. This is somewhat evolved from the fact that the drug on its own was not terribly active as a single agent, but when used in combination with lenalidomide, which is also a known upregulator of the immune system, the results have seemed to be dramatically better. So the trial compared patients with 1 to 3 prior therapies with multiple myeloma. They received as a control arm lenalidomide and dexamethasone in combination as the gold standard. And that was compared to lenalidomide and dexamethasone with this monoclonal antibody elotuzumab, which was given every couple of weeks. And I'd have to actually go back and check the schedule, but essentially the dosing schedule was not onerous on patients. The bottom line trial results showed an improvement in progression-free survival with the combination of drugs of about 5 months. And this was positive across all the subgroups of patients that were studied. And therefore, I think it is likely that this combination, including for the first time a monoclonal antibody targeted to myeloma patients, should be a positive enough study to allow the FDA to give this serious consideration for approval.
So how do you see this? You said you thought it might or would be likely that this would get approved. How do you see this initially being integrated into practice just with lenalidomide or relapse disease?
Well, my guess is the approval will be for lenalidomide in combination with lenalidomide in relapse. But as I already mentioned, the trial in newly diagnosed patients is not far behind. And the data in combination with bortezomib is expected. And I think once those data become available, one would expect to see elotuzumab used more broadly and, as is common with such new drugs, eventually being used earlier as well.
So let's talk about daratumumab. Can you talk about how it actually works? It's an anti-CD38 monoclonal antibody and what we know about it, particularly in terms of what was presented at ASCO.
So daratumumab is a very exciting new introduction into the world of myeloma. It is, again, targeting a cell surface receptor, CD38, on the surface predominantly of plasma cells, but also some immune compartment cells. It has, on its own, and as was presented at ASCO, in over 100 patients, has a single agent activity of around 30%, depending on how you do the numbers. But this has been relatively consistent through phase 1 and phase 2 testing. The dose has been defined. The toxicity profile, which we can discuss a little bit, is essentially known. And this is a drug which, as a single agent, has activity in a third of patients, and when combined with other agents, is likely to be, again, at least additive, if not synergistic. So I think there's high enthusiasm, again, for this monoclonal antibody. The results at ASCO reinforced and expanded on the positive data. This drug is also in phase 3 testing, both in relapse and in newly diagnosed patients, but the expectation is that this will go to the FDA as a single agent for highly refractory patients initially, and that this trial reported at ASCO, if I recall rightly, the Sirius trial will be strong enough, hopefully, to see another approval in our disease.
So another study, a phase 3 trial called the Endeavor study, was also presented at ASCO comparing carfilzomib and dexamethasone to bortezomib and dexamethasone. And then at the prior ASH meeting last December, you presented and then published in the New England Journal the ASPIRE trial, both of these trials in relapsed disease, the ASPIRE trial looking at the addition of carfilzomib to Len-Dex. Can you talk about these two studies and what you think they mean in terms of future clinical practice?
I'd be happy to. So the ASPIRE trial, which was presented last December and published in the New England Journal in January, I should have mentioned earlier, actually, that the elotuzumab paper is also published in the New England Journal now. I forgot to mention that just last month. But back to ASPIRE, this trial compared the second-generation proteasome inhibitor carfilzomib, which is approved in the United States for relapsed refractory disease as a single agent, was to compare this, again, in combination with lenalidomide and dexamethasone versus lenalidomide and dexamethasone alone. This was a large trial, around 700 patients, randomized to the control arm of lenalidomide dexamethasone or the experimental arm, which incorporated carfilzomib. It was 1 to 3 prior relapses, and the results were very impressive for the combination. The progression-free survival was 27 months versus 17 months. It was a 9.5-month improvement, which is that's the best progression-free survival in this population that's ever been reported in a myeloma clinical trial. The complete response rate was 3 times as high. The overall survival was still not statistically positive, but was trending in favor of the 3-drug regimen. And what was most astonishing to me, actually, Neil, was that the quality of life, the global quality of life that patients reported was improved with taking 3 drugs versus 2, which when you think that they're having to go to their physician's office 6 times a month to receive carfilzomib was a surprise, but I think speaks to the power of deep responses and the well-being of knowing that your disease is well controlled and in remission. So this trial, we think, should result, again, in the more widespread approval of carfilzomib for use in earlier disease states in the United States and outside of the United States, the first approvals of carfilzomib around the world, and particularly in Europe. The question that comes up, of course, is that in the United States, many patients receive lenalidomide already at diagnosis or as a maintenance therapy, and therefore the question of the relevance of this 3-drug combination in patients who've already received lenalidomide is one of the things that we have to address. In our own practice, we've tended to combine carfilzomib with either cyclophosphamide in this setting or with pomalidomide, which is, as you know, a slightly more potent version of lenalidomide that's also approved in relapsed refractory myeloma. And that's how we've got around the challenge of lenalidomide refractoriness in our patients who are relapsing. But it does also bring up the Endeavor trial, which you mentioned. And the Endeavor trial, again, a very large trial, I think almost 900 patients in this trial, compared, I think, a very real life situation. So patients who, again, had 1 to 3 prior therapies, the majority of whom had already been exposed to bortezomib. And the question that comes up for the treating community oncologist is, do I use bortezomib again, or do I switch and turn to something like carfilzomib? And this trial compared head-to-head bortezomib and dexamethasone using very standard dosing of bortezomib twice weekly, but could be either subcutaneous or intravenously, versus carfilzomib. And one of the things to watch for here in this trial is the dose of carfilzomib used is double the FDA-approved label. So the FDA-approved label is 27 milligrams per meter squared. This trial used 56 milligrams per meter squared, so a very big dose of carfilzomib compared to what we're used to using. The arms were well-balanced, and I think I've surprised all of us how positive this was in favor of the carfilzomib treatment arm. Perhaps not terribly surprising, given these patients have all been exposed to bortezomib in the past, but nevertheless, the benefit here was substantial, and I don't have the figures right in front of me, Neil, but for bortezomib dexamethasone, it was in the usual range of, you know, 9 to 10 months, and in the carfilzomib arm, it was almost double. It was a good 7 or 8 months longer in terms of the progression-free survival. Depth of response was higher again, and I think it was to most of us, a little bit of a surprise how much better in this setting carfilzomib was compared to bortezomib in terms of response rate, depth of response, and particularly progression-free survival. Now, patients to achieve that have to, many people have switched to using bortezomib weekly, subcutaneously, and therefore patients have to compromise because now they have to come in 6 days a month instead of maybe 4 days a month or every week to receive bortezomib. And there is a trade-off in toxicity as well. So with carfilzomib, there's much less neuropathy compared to bortezomib. On the other hand, there are more adverse events affecting the cardiovascular and renal system, particularly hypertension. And then, although the events are still relatively uncommon, about 5% of patients experiencing a cardiac event and another 3 or 4% experiencing a severe adverse event related to renal function. So there is that trade-off of maybe a 4 or 5% increase in serious toxicities, more hypertension, but then this sort of fairly, very significant improvement in progression-free survival. I think for me, for the treating community oncologists, both of those studies together sort of cement the role of carfilzomib at first or second relapse. Although the toxicity profile is there, we understand what it is now, and we can be a little bit conservative perhaps in the type of patients we put on the study if they have pre-existing cardiac or renal problems. But all told, I think it will result in earlier use of carfilzomib. These two studies together should encourage earlier use of carfilzomib in relapsed myeloma patients, and perhaps also for longer durations of time than the treating physicians have been used to using the drug. So in the ASPIRE trial, the carfilzomib was given for 18 months. In the ENDEAVOR trial, it was given indefinitely until relapse. And I think, you know, most community oncologists and myeloma physicians have been more used to the 4 to 6 month type of range of therapy and then giving their patients a break. These trials would suggest that one should push on and keep going with treatment over an extended period of time as long as the patient is tolerating it.
So in terms of the efficacy numbers that you were talking about, PFS 18.7 versus 9.4 months, so pretty big difference there. Response rate 77% versus 63%. VGPR 54 versus 29, that was pretty different. But isn't it possible that all this could be just explained by prior bortezomib exposure?
Of course. You know, this isn't newly diagnosed proteasome inhibitor naive patients we're studying here. But this is the, I started off by saying this is actually a very real life trial because bortezomib is the drug that almost all of our myeloma patients are getting at diagnosis. So they're all coming in relapsing having had bortezomib. And the real life question for the oncologist is, do I use that again or do I switch to carfilzomib? This trial would suggest carfilzomib is a better choice in this setting. On the other hand, it's important to point out that if a patient has responded to bortezomib in the past and does not have substantial toxicity or neuropathy, and it's a convenient drug to give, that there's nothing wrong with reusing bortezomib, and it's approved for reuse, and many patients could still go that route. But it does, I think, lean the treating oncologist, particularly for the younger, healthier patient, that carfilzomib is certainly an option in this setting and a very powerful one.
The other conclusion I think I've heard a lot of people make from the ASPIRE trial has to do with a very common question we get from oncologists, which is the concept of using two versus three drugs in the relapse setting. You know, oncologists are already used to, from, you know, 20 years ago, hearing, you know, in breast cancer that you use, you know, sequential single agents, because even though you get a better initial outcome with combination therapy, more toxic, and you achieve the same thing sequentially. Are you more inclined now to use both an IMiD and a proteasome inhibitor, for example, in the relapse setting because of the ASPIRE trial?
The ASPIRE trial certainly tells us that the results with three drugs compared to two are superior in terms of depth of response and duration of response. That is very clear. However, and I think for the right patient and for many patients, that cements the value of three versus two drugs, at least in my head. What wasn't done on that study was to have a carfilzomib rescue. So we don't know what the results would look like if you received lenalidomide dexamethasone followed by carfilzomib, or the other way around, carfilzomib dexamethasone followed by lenalidomide. And people did write to us after we published the New England Journal article and asked that question, and we said we just can't address it. It's not known. However, it becomes a matter of whether you're a believer in depth of response being good or whether you're more of a believer in quality of life and sequencing therapies. And to me, it's not a matter of one is better than the other. I think it's what's most appropriate for the individual patient. So there are many patients who will not, for lots of reasons, want to get an intravenous drug 6 times a month for many months on end, either because of age, they're working, many, many factors that would steer them towards a more sequential approach. And many of our myeloma patients are elderly, and a 2-drug approach might be just as good for them. But I think for a younger patient in whom duration of life is important, a younger, healthier patient, to me at least, the 3-drug combination is preferable.
Can you describe maybe a clinical situation, either a theoretical one or actually a patient that you've seen where you chose to use triple therapy in the relapse setting, and maybe the kind of situation where you might not do that?
So most of our patients will start out with a bortezomib cyclophosphamide or bortezomib lenalidomide combination, often have a transplant if they're young enough, and they'll go on some form of maintenance. And more we're using both bortezomib and lenalidomide in maintenance settings. And so what's happening is as they relapse, they've already had significant exposure to both of those drugs. So my bias has been to move to carfilzomib and pomalidomide quite early and frequently. And for the younger, healthier patient, they get the combination of carfilzomib and pomalidomide at relapse. For the more frail or elderly patient, I'm more likely to use pomalidomide perhaps to start with dexamethasone alone or in combination with something like cyclophosphamide. But I do tend to go quite early to that 3-drug combination nowadays, and I've been very happy with the results of using those drugs in combination. And, you know, anecdotally, could probably pull up the charts of many patients who have been struggling, and when we switch them to a combination like that, we have their best response ever, and it's been durable.
You mentioned toxicity with carfilzomib, particularly the cardiac toxicity, the dyspnea that some patients experience. And can you talk a little more specifically, particularly about what you saw in the ASPIRE trial, since it was a randomized trial with or without carfilzomib, in terms of what you saw?
Yeah, and I thank you for bringing that point up, because I have to be cognizant of the trial results here. There's no doubt that with carfilzomib, there's a very small percentage of patients who experience, well, a decent percentage of patients experience dyspnea, but a very small percentage of patients who have a syndrome that looks much like heart failure with fluid retention, shortness of breath, ankle edema. But the encouraging thing was that in both the phase 3 trials, compared to the control arm, there was really no excess in number of patients. So if you look at the number of patients who came off drugs because of an adverse event or had a death due to an adverse event, there's really no difference between the two arms. So lenalidomide dex versus lenalidomide carfilzomib dex, or bortezomib dex versus carfilzomib dex, there really is no impact on death or discontinuation of drug. You really have to dig down a bit into the grade 3-4 toxicity. And in the ASPIRE trial, even there wasn't any meaningful clinical difference. A little bit more evidence in the ENDEAVOR trial, which used twice as much carfilzomib, where there was a 2-3% increase in cardiac and renal events. But remembering that for each of those, that means they're moving from 2-3% to 5-6% of patients experiencing those events. So they're still relatively small numbers. And overall, particularly the ASPIRE trial, where we used the FDA-approved label dosing of carfilzomib, the toxicity profile was actually very reassuring in favor of the combination of drugs.
What's the actual clinical syndrome that you see in terms of the dyspnea? When does it occur? Is this heart failure? I've heard people talk about fluid somehow being involved. What's your take on the whole thing?
Well, we looked quite carefully at 60 patients. It's an abstract. We haven't published it yet. It's been readied for submission. We did echocardiograms. We looked at their creatinine, their blood pressure, their BNP levels, their troponin levels. What we find is an acute rise in the BNP in many carfilzomib-treated patients. So there's a fluid retention syndrome. We did not find reduction in the ejection fraction after 4 months in the vast majority of patients. And when we did find a reduction in ejection fraction, it was almost, and it was only in 3 or 4 patients, it was always associated with a secondary event. Pulmonary embolism, systemic sepsis, and amyloidosis being the 3 that we noted. So we don't think that, I don't personally think that this drug causes cardiac damage the way that something like adriamycin would, but it does cause this acute fluid retention. To me, it's almost a vascular event, Neil, that the blood pressure goes up, there's a pre-renal creatinine rise that's reversible with fluids. The patient looks like they're having some heart failure because they're retaining fluid acutely. And as long as I think if you know it's there and you're aware of it, unless it's severe, I don't think the drug needs to be discontinued. It can be dose reduced or less fluids given, diuretics applied if necessary. It's still a small percentage of patients this happens to. But for the treating physician, I think what you have to be aware of, especially in the first couple of weeks of treatment, which is mostly an acute event, you see early on or you don't see it at all, and it's not something that is cumulative over time, it's usually in the first cycle, you'll see the patient call you the evening of their first or second dose with sometimes with fever, sensation of dyspnea, sometimes their urine output, they feel like they haven't urinated as much. Those are the patients, I think, that you need to be bringing in to watch more carefully and perhaps using a reduced dose. And the one thing we also found was that the patients who entered our analysis with a high creatinine to start with were the ones who went on to see a rise in the creatinine after therapy. So if your creatinine is normal before you take the drug, it's unlikely anything bad is going to happen. If your creatinine is elevated, then I think you, again, have to proceed with caution because it's much more likely that their creatinine is going to bump from 1.5 to 2 up to 3 or 3.5. And I think for a lot of physicians, that would result in stopping the drug very quickly. But I do think there are cases where you can recognize what's happening, let the creatinine normalize and retreat slightly lower dose, maybe with more fluids to prevent renal failure, maybe less fluids if the syndrome is dyspnea. And physicians should be aware of the risk of hypertension and be ready to intervene if that is noted. But I want to re-emphasize the fact that the serious adverse events are relatively uncommon. They're less than, in the Aspire trial, it was only about 3% of patients had a cardiac syndrome like this. But the number of patients who will call you with some dyspnea is actually in the 10 to 20% range.
And do you recommend or do any type of cardiac monitoring routinely in patients who are going to get carfilzomib?
We don't, because when we did the echocardiograms, we didn't find... Actually, what was surprising is how many myeloma patients don't have a particularly good cardiac function to start with. Cardiac strain in our patients was often abnormal, and the baseline BNPs were often abnormal even before we started treatment. That was a bit of a surprise. But we didn't find any evidence that the baseline echocardiogram predicted for anything happening, nor did it really change over the course of therapy. So we don't see any value in a baseline echocardiogram. But in somebody with known cardiac problems, it might not be the first drug of choice. If your patient has known heart failure, I wouldn't use carfilzomib, I don't think. Or known severe renal failure, there are other choices I think would be preferable.
Would you consider an absolute contraindication, or you just, when you run out of other options, you...
Not absolute. These are proceed with caution is the way I would put it. And, I got called the other day by somebody saying, my patient's on dialysis, can I give carfilzomib? And I said, well, honestly, the damage is done. You can't make the kidneys worse. And it has been given in patients with severe renal failure in the past, so I wouldn't consider that an absolute contraindication either. But again, I'd probably dose fairly cautiously in the first few weeks.
So the other issue, of course, and it's being looked at in a big ECOG trial, is the question of carfilzomib up front. What do we know about that at this point, obviously in comparison to bortezomib? And are there situations yourself where you utilize carfilzomib up front?
Personally, I'd love to use it in more patients. We did a clinical trial and we were very happy with carfilzomib in the frontline setting. We did a four-drug combination, actually, Dr. McHale ran with cyclophosphamide, thalidomide, and dexamethasone. It's just an insurance barrier at this point that it's not approved for frontline use, so it's variable whether it gets covered by insurance. At the ASCO meeting, again, there was an update on the use of carfilzomib, lenalidomide, and dexamethasone in combination in newly diagnosed patients. This is a regimen that's been explored in two or three studies now. Carfilzomib has also been combined with cyclophosphamide in the frontline setting, and the results are impressive. Carfilzomib, lenalidomide, dexamethasone, the numbers are not huge, but there's 60 patients on one study, 100% response rate essentially if the patients can stay on the drugs. If you stay on them long enough, and particularly when you combine them with transplant at the ASCO trial, complete response rates in the 60 to 80% range of patients, which is remarkable when you think about it. The fact that you can get 70 or 80% of your patients in a complete remission with any therapy is impressive, but with, carfilzomib, lenalidomide, dexamethasone, which is well tolerated, you can keep going for longer than a traditional 4 months, and you get this very deep response rate. It does start to challenge the assumption that transplant is going to be necessary in the future, particularly as we start to introduce the monoclonal antibodies we talked about, elotuzumab and daratumumab in this setting. One can imagine that these very deep responses in high percentages of patients will translate into a much longer survival. So good news for patients.
And I guess maybe along with that, as you said earlier, we might be looking at one or more monoclonal antibodies in that situation. Let's talk a little bit about new proteasome inhibitors coming out, particularly the oral agents. And you've been very much involved in the research on exazimib. And maybe you can talk a little bit about what that agent is and what we know about it at this point.
Yeah, so exazimib is going to be a disruptive entrant into the marketplace. I think exazimib is an orally delivered proteasome inhibitor. I think it bears some resemblance to bortezomib in terms of its chemical structure, but has a unique ability to be absorbed from the stomach. Early indicators are that it has activity as a single agent in late-stage patients, but I think more importantly, some of the recent papers that have come out have combined exazimib with lenalidomide, dexamethasone in relapse and in newly diagnosed patients, and have shown, again, very high response rates, perhaps 20% complete remissions, perhaps not as high as we've seen with the more potent intravenous delivery of these drugs. But because of the convenience, the fact that you can give them over long periods of time as oral medications, and the fact that they have activity, I think is likely that they're going to be new additions. Exazimib is in phase 3 testing now, again, in combination with lenalidomide dexamethasone, both in relapse in newly diagnosed patients and in the maintenance setting. And I think, honestly, it's going to be very interesting because if these drugs do beat the control, which I would imagine they will because they have activity, and now you have a choice of a orally delivered drug, high response rates compared to perhaps bortezomib or even carfilzomib, which is given intravenously twice a week just now, that's going to be an interesting choice for patients and their physicians to look at. My sense is that carfilzomib and bortezomib delivered systemically are slightly more potent in the short term, at least, than exazimib. But, you know, tortoising the hare here, exazimib may catch up over time because you can stay on it for longer periods of time and the convenience factor is good. The side effect profile of exazimib is that it's quite well tolerated. Actually, my own experience with it has been it's been very well tolerated. The main issues are there is still some neuropathy, but it's not nearly as dramatic as with bortezomib at times. Obviously, thrombocytopenia, some upper GI toxicity, as you might expect, but it's generally fairly manageable. And there are some patients who develop a rash, but again, not often to the degree they have to stop the drug. So my own experience with the tolerability is good. Whether it's as potent as the other drugs, and at the end of the day, physicians and their patients vote for potency or vote for convenience and low toxicity, I think remains to be seen. But I do think this drug will make it. And I think it will be very powerful to have an oral way of delivering a proteasome inhibitor.
You know, it kind of seems like where that convenience factor might fit in, as you said, is that the patient is going to get long-term therapy in the maintenance setting, for example. And you referred earlier to the fact that bortezomib and proteasome inhibition in general is being used more in the maintenance setting. Right now, how do you approach the issue, for example, of post-transplant maintenance in general? And in what situations are you using a proteasome inhibitor?
Well, I'll give you my opinion, and I'll tell you that even in our own center, not everybody agrees on the right way to go here. There's definitely controversy. My own opinion is that maintenance is useful, since most patients are not cured by transplant and four cycles of chemotherapy before that. So I have all of my patients taking lenalidomide maintenance as a minimum, unless they can't tolerate it, in which case we'll use proteasome. So where do we use proteasome inhibitors? In any patient who has high-risk disease, we think is at high likelihood for relapsing early, and in whom we think proteasome inhibition is the trick to try and stop them relapsing, any high-risk patient we will have, genetic high-risk patient, we will have taking both bortezomib and lenalidomide maintenance. And any patient who's intolerant of lenalidomide, we will use bortezomib as an alternative in the maintenance setting. So basically, everybody's getting maintenance with lenalidomide by default, lenalidomide bortezomib if they're high risk, and bortezomib alone if they can't tolerate lenalidomide. That's my own personal practice, although, as I say, not all of my colleagues would follow that pattern. Exazimib would be exciting in this setting, as would the monoclonal antibodies. They're easy to give. They seem to have ability to control disease, and I think the whole issue of how long you treat for and what drugs you use in the long run and then a little bit of balance of the cost and the long-term toxicities become important questions. And still, that's an evolving area.
I was going to ask you, actually, how long you continue the maintenance therapy, if it's lenalidomide or both.
So I tend to keep lenalidomide going for 2, possibly 3 years. I watch the MCV in the peripheral blood very closely because of some concerns about mild dysplasia. And if it's going up and the platelets are falling, I tend to stop the drug. But if we can get there approximately 2, possibly 3 years, I'm tending to use minimal residual disease testing now, Neil, to decide whether to discontinue the drug, either through flow cytometry or molecular MRD testing. And whether that's the right thing or wrong thing to do, I don't know, but that's how I've sort of made the decision to stop or not. The reality of the situation, which people don't talk about much, is that by about 18 months of therapy, a lot of patients are getting a bit fed up with being tired all the time and having diarrhea 2 or 3 times a day. And so often the average duration of therapy turns out to be more like 18 months. With bortezomib, because of neuropathy, I usually just go for 1 year and then stop.
So another oral proteasome inhibitor seems to be chemically related to carfilzomib is aprosimib. And maybe you can talk a little bit about what we know about that and where it is in development.
Yeah, aprosimib is in phase 2 testing now, essentially. The dose is known, the formulation is known. It's an active oral proteasome inhibitor, structurally related to carfilzomib, and would, I think, be another success. The thing that has limited aprosimib has been upper GI toxicity, that nausea, vomiting is a little bit more, I think, than most patients are willing to tolerate, particularly for long-term use. Now, that is improving with time as experience grows. The new formulation has helped. The routine administration of antiemetics to patients has blunted the side effect profile. And I would say it's a lot more tolerable now than it was a couple of years ago when it was first being explored. But again, if you look at staying on this drug for long, extended periods of time and you're having to take antiemetics every day, I think that's a bit challenging. So again, it may find its home and its place, but it's probably not going to have the impact, in my opinion, that ixazomib will.
So I'm interested in your thoughts about a relatively recently approved agent in myeloma, panobinostat. If you could talk about what we know about its mechanism of action, the clinical research activity, and then also your comments. I see there was a paper at ASCO looking at it in combination with carfilzomib.
This is a very interesting drug. Got FDA approval this year. Panobinostat is an orally delivered medication that is a histone deacetylase inhibitor. So it's related to vorinostat and romidepsin, its mechanism of action. Essentially, it silences overactive transcription in the cell and it therefore results in cell death, malignant cell death, where there's excess activity. What panobinostat does on its own is not terribly active on its own. When it's combined, however, with bortezomib, it proved to be quite active in a phase 2 clinical trial. And that resulted in a phase 3 trial called Panorama, which was taken to the FDA last year and successfully resulted in approval of the drug. The trial studied panobinostat and bortezomib versus bortezomib alone in relapsed myeloma. It extended progression-free survival from about 8 months to 12 months, so just over 4 months of progression-free survival improvement. And that was seen, of course, as a positive thing and a good addition, new mechanism of action for this drug. The concern has been the toxicity profile when used with bortezomib. There's a substantial thrombocytopenia, fatigue, and diarrhea. You know, 2/3 of patients suffering from these complications, sometimes relatively severe. So the FDA approved the drug for use in relapse, and particularly in higher-risk younger patients. But they did ask for some follow-up studies to see if the toxicity profile could be better managed. So it was very encouraging at the ASCO meeting, the report of the combination of carfilzomib with panobinostat appeared to be much better tolerated than the bortezomib combination previously reported, mainly with less diarrhea as a complication. So this drug is on the market. It's available now for relapsed patients in combination with bortezomib. It's an option, I think, for patients who, in my own practice, would tend to be a little bit younger and perhaps a little bit higher risk, and more willing to accept the fatigue and diarrhea that might come with using the drug. Probably not a drug I would use all that frequently personally in an elderly population, but it's certainly there and it's got new mechanism of action. And it looks like as we learn more about how to use it, as with many of the drugs we use, we'll be able to learn better how to deal with the toxicity and to reduce it and to manage it with supportive care. And particularly then the use with carfilzomib would be something to consider.
Have you used the drug yourself?
Yes, we have. We were part of the clinical trials of panobinostat, and we used it in a handful of patients after its approval. Again, for some patients, it's a tough drug to take, but for some patients, it's quite active in combination and is worth considering.
So could you describe sort of a optimal clinical scenario where you might use the drug?
Yeah, so for me, it would be a younger patient who has high-risk disease, you know, deletion 17 or T414, who's relapsing relatively quickly after transplant, for example, but in whom bortezomib was active in the past, that perhaps has just progressed on lenalidomide maintenance or full-dose lenalidomide. In that setting, I think we would consider, rather than using bortezomib dex alone, we might introduce bortezomib panobinostat dexamethasone.
I mean, would you use bortezomib dex in a patient like that or carfilzomib?
Well, personally, I might turn to carfilzomib, but again, the question is whether I would add panobinostat to that. I think it's, for me, it's a relatively small population of patients in whom I would do that. But I was pleased with the carfilzomib panobinostat results in terms of toxicity, and it's certainly something we would consider in a higher risk, but again, a younger, higher risk, more physically fit patient.
So you were involved in a couple of abstracts at ASH looking at pomalidomide, either with dex or with bortezomib and dex. Can you kind of provide an update of what we've learned in the last couple of years about pomalidomide and how you're integrating it into your practice?
Yeah, pomalidomide is the third in the immunomodulator class of drugs that binds the protein cereblon, so thalidomide, lenalidomide, and pomalidomide, and they are progressively, in the lab at least, 10 times more potent than one another. Pomalidomide is a great drug. We're fans of pomalidomide. We've had a lot of experience using it. I think it's very well tolerated for the vast majority of patients. Neutropenia is a bit more common than it is with the other two agents in this class. One still has to be concerned about deep venous thrombosis, as with the other agents. But it can be combined, in my opinion, with almost any other drug. With cyclophosphamide, I guess neutropenia would be the limiting factor. So we use a lot of pomalidomide. We tending to use it earlier. My own bias is to use it in combination, either alone or in combination with carfilzomib, quite early on in the treatment course, even at first relapse nowadays. And I think it's a very strong drug, and it's one that perhaps deserves to move earlier into the treatment decision tree than it is currently positioned, where I think for many oncologists, they've tended to use it as a drug of last resort. I don't personally think that's necessary, that you can use it much earlier. Essentially, in any patient who's failing or can't tolerate lenalidomide and you feel there's still a role for an immune modulator. So we're high on pomalidomide. We use it a lot, and we think it's a very useful drug.